listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In this update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean, there's some really disturbing events taking place inside Nicaragua, the nation that hosts our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, and we spoke with him via Skype on Sunday. It seems that, the U.S. machine, whatever it is, Mr. President, no more regime change, somebody seems to have not gotten the memo or is writing a new one, because there's a whole game going on the ground in Nicaragua. Why don't you start there?
Yeah, and the first thing to tell anybody listening to this is don't believe anything that you read on the social media, and don't believe anything, of course, that you read in the mainstream corporate foreign news coverage about Nicaragua. That's the first thing to say. So what's happening? The current events of violence across the country have been in theory, superficially, provoked by a dispute between the private business sector organizations led by an organization called COSEP, the Consejo Superior de la Empresa Privada, which kind of is an umbrella group for all the different private sector business organizations in Nicaragua. They decided over last weekend, over the previous weekend, or the previous week, to withdraw from discussions trying to reach a consensus over social security reform, which is urgently necessary in Nicaragua, as it has been all around the world. And if you look around the world, social security reform has been a key issue for governments and countries in Western Europe, in North America, almost everywhere. And Nicaragua is not an exception to that. They have a deficit currently running at about $75 million in their Social Security program, which is one where current contributions cover current expenses. So it's really urgent to try and resolve that shortfall, that deficit. And the fundamental dispute between Nicaragua's private sector and the government is that the private sector wants to impose a neoliberal reform of the Nicaragua social security system, and the government wants to maintain the social security system as a collective public good.
Right.
So that's the fundamental disagreement. And some people have been saying, oh, well, it's the government's fault because they didn't consult, which is ridiculous because they've been consulting for well over a year with both the private business sector, trade, labor unions, the cooperative movement, rural workers' organizations, the church. It's ridiculous to say that they haven't consulted. They have consulted, and their decision, once the COSEP decided to withdraw from the discussions, was to promote a plan that increased the finance available to the social security system via relatively small increases in contributions, while also maintaining the coverage and benefits, and even extending them to some extent for elderly people, based on agreement with in Nicaragua, there's an organization that is called the Union of Senior Citizens, or the Union of Elderly People, that represents the interests of pensioners. And they supported the government's proposals, among which are a 5% deduction from old people's pensions, but in return for which they get the complete health benefits of an active worker contributing to Nicaragua's social security system.
Mm-hmm.
So, I can give you, if you want, I can give you a quick rundown of the main government proposals and the neoliberal private enterprise, private business sector proposals. Would that be useful?
I guess some context would be useful because, for example, I'm looking at Kirk Semple's article in the New York Times this past Friday, the 20th of April. And, you know, other than blaming opposition to newly announced changes in the Social Security program, and then saying that, you know, for some younger workers, that there is going to be a, you know, somewhat larger, withholding to cover medical expenses. They don't really explain any of the details. And the real thing that they don't do is say, by the way, this is what workers in Nicaragua have and what it costs, as opposed to what workers in Honduras have and Colombia have,
of course.
Of that. Yeah, right. And which is so the real context.
The historical context in Nicaragua is that under 17 years of right-wing governments, the social security system was pillaged and ransacked for the benefit of the private sector. That is the context.
Like the United States. Right, exactly.
Yeah, and in January 2007, the Sandinista Front took power under President Daniel Ortega, and they implemented a series of changes in the social security system that increased coverage, increased benefits, maintained the contributions at a level that was within the reach of ordinary workers. And the IMF, and historically in the region, the regional context is that in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, of course, where the private business sector has been in power and remains in power. Although in El Salvador there've been some mitigation effects as a result of attempts by the progressive FMLN government under President Salvador Sanchez Seren to protect workers' rights. But regionally, the context is that the social security systems are ransacked and pillaged for the benefit of the private business sector. That came to a stop in January 2007 in Nicaragua.
Right.
And ever since then, and the IMF has been, when it had influence in Nicaragua, when Nicaragua was still in an IMF program, and that ended in 2012, I think, the IMF was arguing, well, they were trying to force the government to say, right, we're going to increase the retirement age, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's what the private business sector is saying now. They want to implement the recipe, the IMF recipe for Nicaragua's social security system. And their recipe includes increasing the age from 60 to 65 for retirement, doubling the number of quotas, the weekly contributions that qualify people to receive a pension from 750 weekly contributions, which is equivalent to about 15 years at 50 weeks a year. To 1,500 contributions, which is equivalent to 30 years. And this in an economy where many people don't work more than 5, 6, or 7 months a year. And that's the important thing to remember. This isn't an economy with with a majority of people in formal employment. The majority of people are in informal employment. In the construction industry, in the agricultural and livestock industries in Nicaragua, and that's why increasing the number of contributions to 1,500 equivalent to 30 years at 50 weeks a year is completely impractical here in Nicaragua. So the other things that they want to do are to abolish the reduced pension. The reduced pension is a pension that is paid to older people who, for one reason or another, over the last 20 years, last 30 years, were unable to meet the minimum 750 weekly contributions. And so despite the fact that they don't qualify for a full pension, they get paid a reduced pension. The private business sector want to eliminate that. There's also a minimum pension. The minimum pension is what's paid to people who are on such low earnings that over the years that if they when they retire, they don't even get a pension equivalent to the minimum wage of the average industrial worker. So the minimum pension is something the government brought in to protect pensioners and ensure that no retired person receives less than the minimum industrial wage.
Right.
Other things that the right-wing business sector want to implement are here in Nicaragua, the central bank manages the foreign currency so that every year they have a statutory sliding devaluation of 5%, equivalent to 5% a year. So one of the things in the social security system is that every year they maintain the value of the pension, increasing it by 5% to compensate for that 5% built-in devaluation from the central bank. The other thing that they do is they guarantee what in Nicaragua is called the 13th month. It's like a Christmas bonus. So all workers under Ministry of Labor regulations receive a 13th month, their Christmas bonus, equivalent to 1 month's salary. And in the social security system, all pensioners receive that 1 month bonus, which is equivalent to 1 month of their pension. The private business sector want to abolish that. So, so the private business sector want to abolish all those benefits and keep the contributions that they have to pay as employers the same. So that, and basically what the private business sector is saying, don't affect our rate of profit, cut benefits so that the costs of the social security system drop and we don't have to pay any more money. That's the private business sector proposal.
You know, and on top of that, by the way, just there's another layer of context I just want to throw at that for a moment, which is the NECA Act here in the U.S., which basically is an attempt, another effort by the United States to strangle the economy in Nicaragua in general, which means that solving problems like trying to restore the Social Security pension funds and such that were looted under the last U.S.-backed government is harder because the entire economic situation becomes more problematic.
Of course, absolutely. And this is all part of a coordinated attack against a very successful progressive government that has made the right-wing governments in the region look stupid. And it's made US policy in the region look stupid.
Yep.
Anyway, now let's go back to what the government proposal is. The government proposal is, no, let's not reduce coverage. Let's not reduce our costs. With the economy is now sufficiently productive and people are sufficiently prosperous for us to be able to say we can increase contributions in line with that prosperity and in line with the increase in profits that you in the business sector have enjoyed over the last 5, 6, 7 years, ever since the end of the crisis as a result of the 2008 global financial crash.
Right.
So, and so what they're saying, what the government is saying is, right, we want to introduce in a gradual way over the next 2 or 3 years, a 3.25% increase in the employer's contribution. And likewise, a 0.75% increase in the employees, the workers' contribution.
You're kidding.
No.
It's less than 5% in the aggregate, with 3% in change being borne by the employer.
Oh, of course. Yeah, and let me finish, Don. It's worse than that. And so, and what the government is saying, we're not going to eliminate the reduced or minimum pensions. We're not going to eliminate the maintenance of value against the central bank's 5% annual devaluation. We're not going to eliminate the 13th month Christmas bonus for pensioners. All that stays the same. What we are going to do is ask pensioners who currently do not enjoy full healthcare benefits to pay 5% of their pension so that they get full healthcare coverage.
Wow.
And as I said earlier, the Elderly Persons Union, the Senior Citizens Union here in Nicaragua, has welcomed that move, and they're prepared to pay 5% of their pension to get the incalculable benefits to elderly people who obviously disproportionately have health problems because of their age. They will now get complete health care as if they were an active worker.
Okay, so just for a little context here, me personally, okay, collecting Social Security pay at the moment, because I don't qualify for Medicare yet. I haven't reached the age for Medicare, which is the public health insurance. But my health insurance through my wife's former employer, IBM, I pay about 5/8 of my Social Security monthly payment for the premium, and it carries a $4,000 deductible annually.
Right.
And then about a quarter of my Social Security will go to Medicare. That's here in the U.S. with only 80% coverage of your stuff. So when you're talking about, even if it's a whole 5% contribution to go to cover full health insurance, it's somewhere between 15 and 20% of what it costs in the United States.
Right.
As
okay.
a percentage.
And so, you know, so I'm the... And you can argue about that. You can say, and the private business sector are within their rights to say, oh, well, what about some small businesses with only 10 or 12 employees, and they work on such small margins that a 3% increase in their Social Security costs could throw them out of business?
Yep.
Now, that is a legitimate comment.
Yeah, show us your books. Let's sit down and figure out a solution.
Yeah, exactly. But that's not what they've done. What they right. did was... they withdrew from the talks, and then magically, the country has been thrown into utter chaos, largely partly provoked by foolishly naive young students who swallowed hook, line, and sinker right. the ridiculous right-wing propaganda that the government was trying to screw them over, if you like, by increasing Social Security contributions, without explaining that the right-wing plan was 100 times worse.
Right.
And so what you now have, what are the events here in Nicaragua as a result of this move by the private business sector and their right-wing political organizations? What is going on is an attempt to get political power by the right wing in Nicaragua that enjoy something under, and all recent polls indicate that they enjoyed around 10% national support.
Right.
They're trying to get political power that they cannot get via the electoral road. They, election after election, they've lost by over 60%, right? So,
yep.
And what's going on is partly an attempt at a national level by the right wing to establish quotas of power that they can't get via the ballot box, via elections, by electoral democracy, by and partly it's very clearly an attempt by the United States elements like Ileana Ros-Lehtinen and Marco Rubio and all those people that sympathize with those extreme right-wing fascists to impose do what we want or else diplomacy from the United States on Nicaragua, as they have failed to do so far in Venezuela.
And Cuba. I mean, because a lot of those, like around Rubio and the other one from Florida you just mentioned, you know, these are the Batististas that are still hovering around, you know, some of them in their 80s and 90s hovering around Miami and New Jersey with Menendez, and they're still making policy for the U.S. government.
Yeah, and they still froth at the mouth about democracy and liberty and...
Yep.
As if they know anything about what that might be.
Well, you know, Eskimo Green.
So I'm staying here in Nicaragua. What have been the recent events? Well, on Wednesday, mass demonstrations started from largely from very ill-informed and largely ignorant of the issue university students. But within that, there were already implanted right from the start right-wing, extreme right-wing shock groups. And also working together with obviously bought and paid for delinquent elements from the poorest classes here in Nicaragua.
Suddenly, everywhere at different protests, people had firebombs. For example, what a coincidence! Yeah.
So what have they done? I mean, they've burnt down university precincts. And they've destroyed university precincts. They've attacked healthcare infrastructure. They tried to destroy the Cuban-staffed eye clinic that gives free eye care under Misión Milagro to tens of thousands of Nicaraguans and has done over many years. They tried to destroy that clinic. They've attacked brand new infrastructure, including for many people in Nicaragua, is a symbol of national reconciliation, the Denis Martinez National Baseball Stadium, a state-of-the-art baseball stadium named in honor of Denis Martinez, who played a perfect game for the Toronto baseball team back in whenever it was, 1981, 1982. I think he's one of the few foreign baseball players that ever to achieve the perfect game, if not the only one.
Right.
And he during the 1980s supported the right wing. He was against the Sandinista government. But in recent years, as a result of the reconciliation process, he's become a symbol of national reconciliation.
Right.
And even so, the right wing gangs tried to attack and destroy, thankfully without success, the Denis Martinez Baseball Stadium. They tried to destroy the most modern hospital that was just recently completed in any Central American public health system, the Fernando Vélez Páez Hospital in Managua. They tried to attack that. They tried to attack the Social Security head office in Managua. Throughout the country, they've attacked the municipal offices are in Granada and in León, which are very important tourist centers. They tried to burn them down. They've attacked the houses of individual mayors and political figures. They've murdered journalists. In the process, some protesters have lamentably lost their lives. But in the overall context, it's hardly surprising that there have been fatalities on both sides. Police officers have been killed.
Yeah.
Over 30 police officers are in hospital. And I think the current toll is 3 or 4 police officers murdered. Mm. By gunshots. And Sandinista journalists have been murdered by gunshots. There was a case last night of a young Sandinista journalist shot in the head as he was on air.
Whoa.
And so, you know, and what does that remind you of? Well, it's Libya all over again. It's Thailand all over again. It's Syria all over again. It's the Ukraine. It's the Maidan in Kiev all over again, where opposition gunmen shot their own side and killed their own side so as to provoke, just as they did back in 2002 in Venezuela in Caracas during the attempted coup against then-President Hugo Chavez Frias. The right-wing gunmen killed demonstrators on their own side so as to provoke an even greater popular reaction. So, and all of that is what's going on now here in Nicaragua. That is what is going on. It's an attempt at regime change. It's supported by the worst elements of the United States right wing, working in cahoots with the corrupt maniac government of President Donald Trump. And working together with local right-wing elites, just as they have done in Venezuela.
Okay, so we only have about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we go to some context on this too. And by the way, just stay in touch with us over the next weeks, in case this gets crazy, because maybe it's going to require closer attention than just looking at it once a week. But after the essentially the failed OAS Summit of the Americas in Lima, was it last week or the week before, there's a coordinated effort by the right-wing governments in Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Paraguay, and Peru to step out of UNASUR, which is the real regional integration tent. And maybe we'll talk about some of that, because it seems like there's a whole big push in general to completely change the landscape there.
Yeah, and the conservative restoration is not and it has nothing to do with democracy. It's something imposed by the elites. It's an attempt to usurp democratic participatory power in across Latin America and the Caribbean. The current crisis in UNASUR has been caused by correspondence from 6 countries, the governments of Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Paraguay, and Peru. And they've written to Bolivia's government, which is the pro-tempore head of UNASUR, which is the Union of South American countries. And they've said that they're not happy with the current state of the Secretary Generalship of UNASUR, which has, under Argentina's pro-tempore presidency, they've been unable to reach consensus about who should be the Secretary General. There are problems in the administration of UNASUR, according to these 6 countries. Meanwhile, the countries remaining, Bolivia, Uruguay, Ecuador, Venezuela, Suriname, and Guyana, are determined to try and maintain the UNASUR framework, not allow it to be destroyed by this apparent withdrawal by the much larger countries like Argentina and Brazil. And it remains to be seen whether the UNASUR integration framework can survive this crisis. But it's all part, I think you're right to see this as all part of the same thing. The right-wing elites are working with the United States elites, the corporate elites, represented by the United States government, of course, and the European corporate elites, represented by the European Commission, to try and roll back all the progressive gains, all the improvements for the region's impoverished majority that were achieved by progressive governments in Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina prior to 2015. And that, because that was when the right wing took power in Argentina, was when the coup began against Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, And it's important to remember that as far as the corporate elites are concerned, any improvement in the conditions of life of the impoverished majority comes from what they regard as an unacceptable price in their profits.
Yeah,
they lose, and that's what the everything that's going on in the region is all about.
You know, they need to look at people in Nicaragua, particularly those students, need to look at what Lenny Moreno has planned for the people of Ecuador with the cutbacks in the public sector, in absolute terms, cutbacks. Let's do trade treaties with the United States. In other words, the same agenda is being carried out, but in Ecuador, because Moreno, you know, did his flip once he took power, he's openly discussing what plans he has for these things, and the folks who were, you know, in the streets over a less than 1% increase in their withholding, those that have jobs, might want to pay attention to what happens if the other side gets in power, because that's what they have with Lenny.
Yeah, and we'll see over the next, and I'm sure within the next few days, things will become much clearer, and either people will realize that they've been fooled by the right wing, these protesters, useful protesters, will realize that they've been fooled by the right wing and used as useful idiots, or they won't.
Right.
And if they don't, then the crisis in Nicaragua is likely to be prolonged, and that's going to have a very bad effect on Nicaragua's economy. The issue for the right wing here is, especially for the private business sector, is how much money are they prepared to lose in order to get the quotas of illicit political power that they don't deserve, that they are seeking.
And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens if the government says, okay, fine, you don't want to do the 3% additional contribution, don't, to see if they turn it off. And we've got to stop there, Tony, because we're out of time. But,
okay,
you know, we'll be looking for further updates. If anything starts, you know, happening there that you think is, you know, important for our audience, please, you know, let's get it out there.
Yeah, sure. I certainly will, Don. Thanks.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. These days, we only see spy games on the big screen. But is it any more quieter now on the secret front than during the Cold War? Well, today I talked to Karel Köcher, the former Czechoslovak spy, the mole who has successfully penetrated the CIA itself.
Infiltrating the most powerful spy agency in the world, living a double life for years, knowing that a wrong step could cost you everything, but risking it all to get the job done. What is it like constantly walking on the edge as a double agent? Where is the fine line between patriotism and betrayal of those who trust you? And is all fair in the war of spies?
Karel Köcher, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us. So in what sense was the CIA different from the Soviet bloc intelligence? What was better and what was worse?
Well, it was very different. I would say, first of all, my experience with Soviet intelligence is that they were better educated, better qualified. They spoke languages much better because the KGB intelligence service hired university graduates. I mean, people with a master's level or higher, while the CIA hired people with a bachelor's degree, and then they trained them and gave them courses and so forth. In the comparison runs really in favor of the Soviet intelligence.
So how did you feel about other agents who were like you, double agents, pretending to be one side working for another? Do you see them as traitors, or do you view them as simply professionals who are doing their job?
Well, those are, you know, very different kinds of people. There are people who really betray their country for money, and They are really double agents in the worst sense of the word. I don't consider myself really a double agent. And how do I feel about them? I don't like traitors on any side. I understand even the Soviet intelligence needed, agents who were betraying the United States or England and so forth. But those people do it for money. I didn't ever hear of anyone working for Soviet intelligence only for, well, except for Kim Philby, so conviction. You know, Ames certainly did it for money.
So tell me something. How does it work in these agencies? Do intelligence agencies just assume that they are inevitably infiltrated? Do they take that into account in their work, or does that realization take them by surprise?
As far as CIA is concerned, it did indeed take them by surprise. They just couldn't imagine that somebody could infiltrate them, you know, go through all the security checks and so forth. And, you know, CIA badly underestimates people from other countries, and particularly from what they call East Europe. So they couldn't simply, for the love of God, think that somebody from East Europe could outsmart them. I've heard often to say, you know, those are terrible people, those Czechs and those Russians and so forth. But of course, you're not like them. You are like us, you know. It was really offensive.
What is realizing that there is a mole in your ranks due to an agency? Is there a panic all around suspicion, witch hunt? What happens?
Yeah, what happens is indeed a panic. When in the late 80s, Ames was giving the names of American agents in the Soviet Union, about, I don't know how many, but about 11 or 12 were caught. There was absolute panic in the CIA. They went as far as trying to get in touch with me and try to persuade me to give them some kind of hint. Who could that be? They even arranged a meeting with me in Munich for that purpose. And of course, they didn't learn anything from me, surely enough. But yeah, they were panicky.
So you turned to the intelligence work because the state secret police harassed you to the brink. You needed them to stop ruining your life. Are most of the people recruited into this job like that, through pressure, fear?
It depends. For Americans, yeah, it's mostly a career like any other. There are certainly nationalists and people who have patriotic feelings, but I think that's secondary. The primary concern is the pay, the career, the kind of certainty they have of employment. My experience with the Soviet or Russian side was that they were more idealistic. They did it out of persuasion and service for their country. I mean, that was primary on the first place.
So in the times of the Cold War, agents could be recruited on ideological grounds, help the global fight for justice, equality. These days, is all of that done just for cash? Are the days of ideas gone?
Well, in the West, the days of ideas, I am afraid, are gone. Not necessarily in Russia, but most definitely in Western world. But even in Russia, I think they must have problems, because you now have consumer society and money is very powerful. So I think the danger of having been infiltrated is much higher. I mean, at the time when I was working for the CIA, the CIA realized it was extremely difficult to recruit an agent in the Soviet Union, and they certainly couldn't operate in the country. They had practically no operations, whatever. Now it is very different, and certainly the Russian intelligence has to take this into account.
So what is like the ultimate motivator for someone to find themselves in this job? Is it money? Is it fear? I don't know, maybe vanity? or a desire of a thrill, adrenaline? What is what's more?
Well, what is it? What's more depends on the kind, what kind of a person you are. But with me, it was really a desire to perform public service. It was some kind of patriotic commitment. There were such people in the CIA as well, but not that many.
How good was the money in the business back then?
Oh, very bad. Czechoslovak intelligence didn't pay me anything at all, with the exception of expenses, like when we had a meeting somewhere in Paris or, I don't know, Vienna, they would pay for the airline ticket and for the hotel, but I didn't get any salary at all. So the pay in the CIA was acceptable. It was better than when I was teaching at college. I made less money than I made in the CIA, but it wasn't really too great. I mean, it was enough, but not much.
So what is more important for an undercover spy? Is it being careful or is it being brave?
Again, it's a matter of what kind of a person you are. But it's not that you want to be a James Bond and do daring things. But when it comes to doing something dangerous, you do it and you find out, how fearful you are. But it worked fine for me. I mean, I'm sure I was sometimes afraid of doing something risky, but I could live with it. But I was careful enough not to be caught. I mean, I was caught because I was betrayed. Mm.
So I know you were offering your superiors to use NGOs as umbrellas for spying activities, but they didn't go for it. Was that foresight of your part on your part, or is your idea in use now? And if yes, then how is it done?
CIA is outsourcing this kind of thing. They are doing the job that the CIA should be doing itself, but it seems safer and simpler to have a non-governmental organization do it for them. But basically, it's just an extension of covert operations activities. That didn't exist because you couldn't operate through a non-governmental organization in the Soviet Union. So that's something which came with the end of the Soviet Union.
Is everyone doing it now? All the agencies doing this now, using non-governmental organizations as umbrellas?
Yes. Well, certainly there are plenty of them in the Czech Republic, plenty of them everywhere. But I don't think it is so extensive from the Russian side. And I really don't believe that Russia has such a strong interest in really influencing the political situation in other countries. Maybe some, but certainly not to that extent as the Americans.
All right, we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking with Karel Kocher, former Czechoslovak spy, the mole who successfully penetrated the CIA during the Cold War, talking about the secret world of intelligence services. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
And we're back with Karel Kocher, former Czechoslovak spy, the mole who successfully penetrated the CIA during the Cold War, discussing what the life of undercover intelligence agents is like or was like. So, Mr. Kocher, are women as effective in espionage as we get from movies and from books? Is the image of a seductive vixen getting atomic secrets out of you on a lover's bed anywhere close to reality?
Well, I strongly doubt it. Maybe the Israelis are using women in this capacity, but otherwise I don't know of anything of that sort. There were Americans were trying to charge me and my wife working this way, but that's absolute fiction. We never even thought it was absolute nonsense. I had top secret clearance, and there was no reason whatever, I mean, to use this kind of offers.
So this is basically just made up
much
by
of it is simply fiction.
Yeah, films and books, right? In real life.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I really don't think so.
But you said You said Israelis use women.
Israelis.
How do they use these women?
Yes. That's. Well, if they want to kidnap somebody, or if they want to blow up something, so they would send, a car with two women who chat up the policeman who is guarding that place and ask him to fix their car and so forth. And in the meantime, their colleagues climb the wall and put explosives on barrels with chemicals or radioactive material whatsoever. But and of course, who used it? The service that used women and men in this capacity was East German intelligence service. They were very good at it. But we didn't do it, and I really don't know of anything of that sort taking place in the Soviet intelligence service. Certainly it did, but on a small scale, compromising people from the diplomatic corps in Moscow, this kind of thing, everybody does that. But otherwise not. During my time, it was just a masculine kind of job, sort of James Bond style without women.
So can you fish for useful information for somebody without having an access to the classified data at CIA, BND, or elsewhere? Do you necessarily have to be engaged with security services in the country you're spying on to get useful information?
Well, it's certainly the best way, but it depends what kind of intelligence you want to acquire. You can also pose as a scientist or well-qualified scientist and get a job with some contractor who is producing some secret kind of weapon and so forth. You don't have to be necessarily engaged in a secret service, but you have to have clearance. And the clearance is issued either by the Pentagon or by the intelligence services. The key to getting information is a clearance.
So a bunch of Russian sleeper agents were exposed by the United States in 2010. I don't know if you remember that story. They all held usual jobs.
Yes, I remember that very
right?
well.
So they were like random usual jobs,
yes.
Real estate agent, car salesman, and they lived normal, mundane lives. So what kind of intelligence can you get if you're like a cook? Or if you're a travel agent?
That's hard to say, but if you are a sleeper, you are just getting ready. It means that in a few years or a couple of years, you might apply for a job with some kind of military contractor, even as a cook.
So what happens to people who wear sleepers for years and years? I mean, they have kids, they grow up, then one day these kids wake up and they find out they're not even American and their parents aren't who they thought they were. When you were outed, were people around you in shock?
Yes, they were indeed in shock. But strangely enough, most of them stayed friends. They said they understand I defend my country as they would defend theirs. And then we still are in touch with quite a few of our friends from the time, American friends.
So can someone like you, a spy, a double agent, ever get out of the game completely? I mean, you had a break for some years and you thought you were out, and then a letter comes in and bum, and you're reactivated. Do spies ever retire?
Well, I strongly doubt it. This is a stuff from films and thrillers from books and TV series. I don't think so. It would be most unusual, and I certainly am out of the business.
So if someone wants to be completely out, then that's his choice and nothing's going to come in the way? Because I've heard different stories. I've heard that when top agents want to leave the profession or change the profession, they're not let go completely.
Well, it depends what kind of an agent it is. I believe that if you really want to get out, you know how to do it. You move to a different continent, you change identity. It's always possible, even without the help of the authorities. I mean,
so is that the only way? I mean, if you want to leave
documents.
So is that the only way? If you want to leave the agency and they don't want to let you go, then you have to change your identity and go to a different continent? That's the only way to leave the profession?
Well, if you really are had access to very sensitive information, that's what I would advise such an agent to do. But otherwise, I don't think it's really all that dangerous. Or if you want to leave, you leave. In most cases, they will let you go. You know why? Because it doesn't make sense to force somebody to do something that he doesn't want to do.
But are intelligence agencies vengeful?
Well, yes. CIA was certainly vengeful. They did try to compromise me, and they certainly spread false rumors. They tried to spread ugly stories about me to... Yes, they are vengeful. CIA was certainly very vengeful. Or the FBI. I would say more the FBI than the CIA.
So do you think Sergei Skripal's case is something like that? A double agent paying for what he did? I mean, the Russian intel official said that he was exchanged and sent off to the United Kingdom because he was no more of any use to Russia. So then it wasn't the Russians who tried to get him?
Well, certainly, if he was exchanged, that was it. As far as Russia is concerned, I honestly believe it. They had absolutely no interest on Skripal at all. And furthermore, I mean, there is a very important point I would like to make. Russian intelligence certainly uses illegal agents, so-called... You know what an illegal agent is. It's no cover. They use agents that have no diplomatic cover, and they are certainly exposed to grave dangers. And when they are caught or arrested, the only way to get them back home is to have them exchanged. So there is no way that the Russian side would endanger this kind of exchange business. So Skripal most definitely wasn't a victim of any kind of operation or attack from the Russian side, because that would totally destroy Russian credibility as far as exchanges are concerned. And they are dependent on it, because they certainly have to get their people back if they get into trouble.
So the Russians are now saying that the British intelligence is hiding Skripals from everyone. Do you think that could be the case?
Well, they certainly are hiding him. I mean, the most natural thing would be, at least for his daughter, who seems to be in good shape, to appear at a press conference or to talk to journalists. They certainly are hiding the two of them as much as they can.
So like you said, Skripal was of no real value to the Russian intelligence. Why do you think that the British are so adamant at blaming the Russians if their case is so thin?
Well, there is certainly some kind of scenario of anti-Russian operations, and Skripal just became a good opportunity. I really don't believe that Skripal was attacked. I think there was maybe an accident, or maybe there was nothing at all. Maybe that this was just made up to have some kind of reason to escalate anti-Russian operations and sanctions and publicity. I really don't believe that anybody from the Russian side would try to cause him harm.
Do you think that the British will ever allow the Russians to meet with the Skripals?
I don't think so.
Why?
Well, because the whole thing is so suspicious. You know, you cannot know what he's going to say. And maybe Skripal himself would not be willing to do what they order him to do. He is obviously a traitor, is not a very reliable person. Not a moral person. So even if he agrees to say what they tell him to say, he might change his mind when he's speaking on camera. I don't think they would ever allow him to meet with the Russians.
All right. Thank you very, very, very much for this really interesting insight into the world of a top spy. Mr. Kocher, we were talking to Karol Kocher, a former Czechoslovak spy, the mole who successfully penetrated the CIA during the Cold War, discussing the role intelligence agents play in global politics. Well, that's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.